VOA.com.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, NATO warning Russia to pull back in Ukraine. UN approves new peacekeeping force for Central African Republic. 4 million Sudanese face food insecurity. Plus, Intel leads with conflict-free chips. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. NATO has released satellite photographs showing what they say are 40,000 Russian troops massed near the Ukraine border, along with tanks, aircraft, and other hardware said to be awaiting orders from Moscow. That satellite intelligence comes as the government in Kiev seeks to diffuse tensions in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian protesters seized control of government buildings earlier this week and issued demands for a vote on joining the Russian Federation. NATO is again warning Russia against escalating tensions in Ukraine along the Ukrainian-Russian border. VOA's Jeff Seldon has our report.
As a U.S. guided missile destroyer, the USS Donald Cook entered the Black Sea to reassure nervous allies, NATO Thursday released satellite images showing Russian forces sitting along the Ukrainian border. The pictures show artillery battalions, helicopters, fighter jets, and special forces. In all, 35,000 to 40,000 troops. Meeting with Czech officials in Prague, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
If Russia is serious about a dialogue, the first step should be to pull back its troops.
Russia remains defiant, a state-run news agency quoting a Russian general and saying the NATO images are old, from last year. Russian President Vladimir Putin also denies Moscow's actions are part of any larger plan.
I just want to say that all decisions were made after it became clear what the mood of the people was. We didn't prepare for such developments.
Meanwhile, in parts of eastern Ukraine, pro-Moscow protesters called for more Russian intervention.
Russia will never leave us in trouble. I also want to call on Putin to help us, the southeast of Ukraine. Those who don't want help should go to the west.
In Kiev, Ukraine's acting president urged them to surrender.
There is no need to adopt a law on amnesty. We guarantee there will be no criminal prosecution of people who give up their weapons and leave the buildings.
But back in the east, a Ukrainian military convoy on the move ran into resistance from villagers, not happy to see a show of force. And despite Russian threats to cut off gas supplies to Ukraine, NATO and the U.S. aren't backing down either. On his way back from a trip to Asia, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel called his Ukrainian counterpart, assuring him the U.S. would continue to stand by Kiev. While U.S. F-16s took off during a pre-planned training exercise with Romanian forces. And back at the entrance to the Black Sea, a French warship sailed in to take part in military exercises. Another show of force aiming to bring calm to a troubled region. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Also in the news, the UN Security Council has approved an expanding peacekeeping force of 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police for the Central African Republic. They will become operational in September and replace the current African Union peacekeeping mission. French Ambassador Gerard Araud told reporters the African and French forces have been working hard on the ground, but the security situation remains volatile, and the authorization of the new UN force will be a turning point.
Their mandate under Chapter 7 will focus on protection of civilians, restoration of law and order, support to humanitarian access, monitoring of human rights, and fight impunity.
Also, the Security Council on Thursday, U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power, who visited the Central African Republic this week, said the violence the country has witnessed has brought it to the edge of disaster. Food insecurity in Sudan could affect as many as 4 million people in the coming months. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization blames conflict, displacement, and poor harvest. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The FAO says currently there are 3.3 million food insecure people in Sudan. That figure is expected to rise by 700,000 due to a lack of availability and access to food. Roseanne Markosich is the agency's representative in Sudan.
The numbers are quite astonishing.
She says Sudan is facing what she calls an early lean season.
When the harvest is finished and the amount of locally available food is diminished, that's what the lean season is.
Markosich says food support is needed for millions of households in Sudan. The reasons are many.
We have the issue of conflict. You see that in the Blue Nile, South Kordofan, and especially in Darfur right now. And you see huge displacements. There were about 380,000 people displaced just in 2013. And in the new year, up until the figures of April the 7th, we see an additional displacement of 280,000 people just in the Darfur region alone.
And livelihoods play a role as well.
Lack of economic opportunities for the people, which result in conflict, issue of natural resource management, conflict between farmers and agriculturalists and herders, for example. And then you also see drought and flood. So it's really a combination of human disaster and natural disaster, a combination of the two.
The lack of availability of food in many places in Sudan has caused food prices to jump.
You can see an increase in food prices at about 84% for meat, 45% for sugar, 40% for vegetables, and 70% for transport, which is very much linked to access and availability of the food.
The conflict in South Sudan only adds to the situation as refugees cross the border seeking safer haven.
It is very, very important that we continue to provide the people and the host communities and the returnees and also those people in IDP camps with seed so that they can plant. And many are leaving the camps and returning back to their homes, and they're returning to nothing. So these people need to have seeds and tools so that they can plant and have a harvest.
Besides thousands of metric tons of seed, the FAO official says nearly 1 million farming tools need to be distributed. What's more, Sudanese herders need help too.
We need to ensure that the herders' livestock is vaccinated, that they are receiving fodder to keep their animals healthy, because having livestock is not only a very important status symbol for the families, but it is a way of ensuring nutrition security as well as food security, because it is a source of protein and its byproducts, either through dairy or through eggs or through the meat that is consumed.
More than 11.5 million livestock would be vaccinated under the FAO plan. The UN agency says its interventions would cost $19 million. So far, donors have provided $7 million. So animal vaccinations and farming tool distribution are far short of the target numbers. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Access to improved drinking water and sanitation is extremely uneven within individual countries in sub-Saharan Africa. That's according to a new report by researchers with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Investigators say access to clean water is highly variable, ranging from a low of 3.2% in some districts of Somalia to as high as 99% in Namibia's urban centers. Adequate sanitation facilities are equally inconsistent. Improved sanitation, the report notes, ranged from 0.2% in parts of Chad to close to 100% in Gambia. Researchers used statistical models in their analysis of data from 138 national surveys conducted in 41 sub-Saharan African countries between 1991 and 2012. The surveys recorded information on household use of an improved drinking water supply, improved sanitation facilities, and open defecation. According to the latest findings, rural households in the districts with the lowest levels of access within a country were 1.5 to 8 times less likely to use improved drinking water, 2 to 18 times less likely to use improved sanitation, and 2 to 80 times more likely to defecate in the open compared to rural households in districts with the best coverage. The authors say strategies that target the areas with the lowest coverage are essential to achieving universal access to improved sources of drinkable water and sanitation. According to a joint report by the World Health Organization and UNICEF last year, more than 2 billion people, or one-third of the world's population, will remain without access to improved sanitation by 2015. A United Nations Millennium Goal on Clean Water and Sanitation calls for cutting in half the number of people who, in 1990, lacked potable water and clean toileting facilities. Last year's WHO-UNICEF report noted that the world has met the target in cutting in half the proportion of people without access to improved sources of water 5 years ahead of schedule. The global assessment, however, may be masking progress toward the goal in Africa. Matthew Freeman of Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health in Atlanta is co-author of the report on clean water and sanitation distribution in sub-Saharan Africa. While the study did not address the UN's Millennium Goals, Freeman says the assessment of worldwide progress toward increased access to clean drinking water is being driven largely by progress by emerging countries in Asia.
China and India, their rapid urbanization and infrastructure investments have led to dramatic changes in access to improved water supply. So globally, that target was met, but few countries in sub-Saharan Africa have met those targets.
Experts are quick to point out there's still time for the UN goals to be met in sub-Saharan Africa. Countries that have already achieved the clean water goal, according to experts, include Gambia, Congo, Gabon, Malawi, Uganda, Burkina Faso, Guinea-Bissau, and Swaziland. The authors of the London School report say making the in-country data on sanitation and drinking water available points up inequities hidden by national statistics. They note it's essential to improving basic infrastructure in areas with the lowest access to clean water and sanitation to prevent the spread of infectious diseases. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Libya military says it has regained control of at least one oil-exporting port in the east of the country following days of negotiations with separatists demanding a larger share of oil revenues. Edward Uranian reporting now, an agreement to open two ports has been reached, but negotiations continue over others.
Agreement by the two sides to reopen oil ports after a nine-month militia blockade was hailed as a breakthrough after a long and bitter tug of war. Talks between the interim government and the separatist militia occupying the ports had been going on for days. Justice Minister Ali Mirghani told journalists the government would set up a commission to investigate alleged financial improprieties as demanded by the separatists. He said the government reached an agreement with the separatists to open the ports of Zweitina and Harega immediately, while reopening the ports of Sidra and Ras Lanuf west of Benghazi within 2 to 4 weeks. But he added talks are continuing over Ras Lanuf and Sidra. The Ras Lanuf and Sidra ports remain under control of militia commander Ibrahim Jadran, who is an ally of the self-proclaimed separatist regional government of Barka. Libyan military spokesman Colonel Ali Sheikhi says the port of Harega is now under government control. He says Harega port is now in the hands of the Libyan National Oil Company and under operational control of the Arab Gulf Oil Company in order to resume oil exports. Unconfirmed reports on Arab TV channels indicate militiamen may still be blocking operations at the Zweitina port.
But a spokesman for the separatist Barka Regional Authority insisted two of the four ports it was occupying have been handed back to the government. He also said discussions would continue over the fate of the final two ports his group controls, but a financial arrangement with the government had yet to be reached. He claimed government operations of the facilities in the past were tainted by fraud. Libya exported up to 3.5 million barrels of oil per day before the uprising against ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi began in February of 2011. The central government says it needs to resume exports in order to fund its operations. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
An air and sea hunt for the missing Malaysian jet resumed today in the same part of the southern Indian Ocean where an underwater sensor made the fifth detection of a signal in recent days, raising hopes that searchers are closing in on what could be a flight recorder. The latest acoustic data is being analyzed. If confirmed, the signal would further narrow the hunt for the Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777, which vanished March 8th while flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. It had 239 people on board. Meantime, specialists are busy at work in the U.S. state of Massachusetts preparing the underwater vehicle, which will be deployed in the Indian Ocean when the general location of the missing plane is identified. William O'Halloran is director of marine operations at Bluefin Robotics, which manufactured the Bluefin 21 submarine.
One of the great things about it is that it can work at the extreme operational environment, the great depths that we're expected to have to survey, and that allows us to put the vehicle down, map the area, and return objects of interest.
O'Halloran went on to explain how the Bluefin sub will make its surveys of the ocean floor.
To conduct surveys and searches in the subsea world, things move at about 3 nautical miles per hour, you know, not very fast. So to get the information that we need to solve these mysteries and others, it's going to take time and it's going to take the technology to be put to work.
Well, the Bluefin submarine does move slowly and would take 6 to 8 weeks to canvas the current underwater search zone. That's why they say the acoustic equipment is being used to get a more precise location. Australian Air Force has been dropping sonar buoys to maximize the sound detectors operating in the search zone. Manufacturer of modern electronic components such as computers and smartphones requires rare minerals found in some of the world's worst conflict areas. Earlier this year, a major U.S. computer chip maker, Intel Corporation, announced that it had stopped buying minerals from the conflict zones and that its products are now conflict-free. VOA's George Pudich reports.
Gold, tantalum, tin, and tungsten are often called conflict minerals because they come from the regions plagued by some of the world's worst violence. One of them is Democratic Republic of the Congo, where the commodity's high value is fueling fighting over the mineral-rich areas. Intel's conflict-free program manager, Carolyn Duran, speaking via Skype, says it took several years to carefully build a new infrastructure to avoid inadvertently supporting the conflicts.
We know where those minerals show up in our products. We know which suppliers provide us parts or components that have those in them. So we actually spent the first couple of years, as I said, mapping the supply chain out to get to the smelter.
Duran says Intel required the smelters to show the sourcing of the minerals so the corporation could be sure that they were conflict-free. But simply switching to suppliers from other parts of the world could hurt non-combatants in conflict zones who depend on the jobs in the mines. In order to minimize the effects of the loss of those jobs, Intel is also helping other humanitarian efforts in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
We do support in-region programs, which helps provide a source of livelihood for those that are legitimate miners in the region. And we are investigating other opportunities to see from a broader corporate social responsibility if there's more that we can do in the region.
But other high-tech manufacturers continue to buy from conflict zones. Duran says she hopes Intel's initiative prompts them to reconsider their sources.
Our hope is that as we become more public on it and demonstrate that this can be done, that the others would do the same thing, that they would look through their supply chains and ensure that they know the source of origin for the minerals and materials they use too.
Although Intel has invested time and resources in this initiative, Duran says consumers will not see any increase in the prices of Intel's chips. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Voice of America is using new high-tech equipment in an effort to bring you news stories with a unique perspective. One of these devices is Google Glass and its ability to show you POV, or point of view of the wearer. VOA's Carolyn Brasuti marries the idea of POV with a young and hip American band.
One more time.
The a cappella group Pentatonix, seen here on YouTube, gained fame mainly through the internet. Their YouTube channel has more than 5 million subscribers. Their rendition of Daft Punk has more than 63 million views. Their Facebook page, 1 million plus fans. Twitter, nearly 300,000 followers. The Pentatonix 2014 North American tour was sold out before it even started. And all the European stops are sellouts. They are a unique band that gained popularity in a new way on the web. So we thought we would offer them a cutting-edge opportunity with VOA's Google Glass.
So tap it, 707, tap it.
Prior to the group's Washington, D.C. concert, I went backstage to teach lead singer Scott Hoying how to use Glass to record video.
Google Glass Pro right here.
Right before Pentatonix performed its original hit, Natural Disaster, Scott explained to the audience what was up.
We are honored to be able to have a pair of Google Glass from Google Glass at Voice of America.
I feel like a Star Trek character with these on. I'm really excited. I feel like I have superpowers.
He then taught the audience the song's chorus while I shot from the crowd on my iPhone.
You're a natural disaster. All right, you guys, belt it out. You're a natural disaster. Natural disaster. Beautiful. I'm excited.
It's a use of Glass as it's intended, giving the POV, point of view, of the wearer.
And hopefully these don't fly off my head.
In this case, a performer's perspective from the stage.
One, two, three.
And then the group belted out the lyrics along with the audience. No disaster here, totally natural, even with the unusual point of view.
You're a natural disaster.
With Google Glass and Pentatonix, Carolyn Brasuti, VOA News, Washington.
Swiss pilot has unveiled what could be a history-making aircraft designed to fly around the world, powered only by the sun. The Solar Impulse 2 will begin test flights next month in preparation for a planned around-the-world trip next year. Plane has the same wingspan as a jumbo passenger jet, but only weighs about the same as a large car. That's because instead of heavy fuel tanks, Solar Impulse 2 is powered by more than 17,000 solar cells, grabbing energy from the sun and storing it in the batteries. Well, pilot Andre Borsborg says he expects to take 5 days and five nights to travel around the world, but he says Solar Impulse 2 could stay in the air indefinitely. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. You know, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On April 11, 1689, William III and Mary II were crowned as joint sovereigns of Britain. In 1713, the main treaties ending the War of the Spanish Succession were signed in the Dutch city of Utrecht. The conflict dealt in part with who should sit on the Spanish throne, but ended up ushering in an era of British global dominance. On this day in 1865, just 2 days after Confederate troops surrendered to Union forces, U.S. President Abraham Lincoln delivered his last public address. He spoke to a crowd outside the White House about the post-war reconstruction of the country and voiced support for black voting rights. This enraged one member of the crowd, actor John Wilkes Booth, who 3 days later shot and killed Lincoln at Washington's Ford's Theater. In 1945, elements of the U.S. Third Army liberated the Buchenwald concentration camp near Weimar, Germany. Tens of thousands of inmates had died in the brutal Nazi camp. In 1951, U.S. Army General Douglas MacArthur, Allied commander of U.N. forces in Korea, was relieved of his duties by President Harry Truman after criticizing U.S. policy and threatening to attack China. In 1961, the trial of Nazi official Adolf Eichmann began in Jerusalem. Eichmann was accused of crimes against humanity for his part in the extermination of millions of Jews and others during World War II. He was found guilty and sentenced to death, a verdict that was carried out the following year. In 1968, U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed a Civil Rights Act prohibiting racial discrimination in the sale, rental, and financing of housing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than 150,000 people have been killed in Syria since Bashar al-Assad first used force against peaceful anti-government demonstrators 3 years ago. Now, added to that horrific toll is yet another killing of a prominent Catholic priest, a Dutchman by birth, who lived and worked in Syria for nearly 50 years and considered his home to be among the Christians and Muslims who once lived peacefully together in the city of Homs. Jesuit priest Frans van der Lucht was shot to death in Homs on April 7th. He had gained international prominence through a video clip released earlier this year when he described how Syrians in the city were dying of malnutrition after the delivery of food and other humanitarian assistance was blocked for months by the Syrian regime. Father van der Lucht insisted on staying in Homs even after more than 1,000 people were allowed evacuated in February. He ministered to a dwindling Christian community and worked to help both poor Christian and Muslim families. The Syrian people have given me so much kindness. If they are suffering now, I want to share their pain and their difficulties, he had said. No one has claimed responsibility for Father van der Lucht's death, which was strongly condemned by Syria's opposition National Council. In a statement, the council said it firmly supported the quest to find and hold accountable those who perpetrated what it called this cowardly act. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki also denounced the violent attack that killed Father van der Lucht, whom she commended for his lifelong support of the Syrian people, and she condemned all attacks against innocent civilians and minority communities.
As we have said throughout this conflict, we deplore continued threats against Christians in Syria, and we reiterate that we stand on the side of the Syrian people who are fighting for a Syria that is inclusive and pluralistic and respects all faiths.
Father van der Lucht once said, I don't see Muslims or Christians. I see, above all, human beings who hunger to lead a normal life. That hunger survives the death of this advocate for the Syrian people, one who counted his place among them. The Assad regime must work to move forward on a negotiated political transition that can end the conflict and the suffering of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.